Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for the new screensavers is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. The new screensavers is brought to you by Audible.com. To download the free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/NSS. And by The Journal, a new monthly email newsletter from our own Kevin Rose. To gain insider access to Kevin's best of the web, sign up today for free at www.thejournal.email. And by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with one simple integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/NSS.
An arcade in your home, Leo and Jason go head-to-head with the HTC 10. And is the big one coming? Live from the Twit Brick House in beautiful downtown Petaluma, it's the new Screensavers!
My ears, there's so much clapping.
That was Phil Casper, Dallas, Texas. Hello, Phil. We salute you and Amanda. And by the way, salute you and Amanda. They brought us beer.
Nice.
This is, he says, this
my
is his favorite
guest.
From Adalbert's in Austin, Adalbert's Brewery. This is Contemplating Waterloo, gin-barreled, aged Belgian-style Saison. Should we open this up?
Fantastic.
All right. Yeah.
All right. I like it. I like the offerings here.
I think we need
Belgian
two pills
style.
In your glass. Woo. Whoa! So
is this how you always start a screensaver?
Yes, that's
with a nice
Jason Howell
tall
over
glass
there.
Of beer.
Oh, that, I like saisons because they're slightly sour. They're so lovely and refreshing on a nice hot summer day.
I like this.
Jason is the host of All About Android every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern Time, 2400 UTC, and of course TNT Monday
Fantastic.
Through Friday, 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern Time. Do you like it? How before the beer, I can do the calculations in my head. UTC Eastern Pacific.
Cheers.
Watch it deteriorates. We have.
It does, especially when you're drinking beer.
Doesn't that smell good? Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that. That's really nice of you.
And, you know, it's not, like, refrigerated.
It's a little warm.
It's kind of room temperature, but it works.
Isn't it good?
It's very so good. I love it.
We're excited because the main cabinet's been here. How long have you been working on this main cabinet?
It's closing in on a year at this point.
Now, we should thank Diami Plotke because he did the woodwork, which is gorgeous.
I mean, honestly, we're going to talk all about the main cabinet in a little bit, but it's one of those things where literally there's no way on earth I could have done this alone.
So pretty.
I'm so privileged that Diami helped.
We'll take a look inside and outside, the guts and everything. We're also going to talk about the big one. We keep waiting in California. We know the big one's coming.
The big one. Then I have to face it.
Well, we happen to have a seismologist, a tame seismologist, who joins us from that time, Julian Lozos. We're going to talk about, I borrowed your Pixel because, I was thinking, Google I.O. is coming up on Wednesday.
Right.
Probably going to be a new Chromebook Pixel. So I thought we'd take your old Chromebook Pixel and we'd freshen it up with a nice new coat of Linux all over it. So as you may know, Chrome OS is Linux, but kind of locked down, which makes it super secure. But I always thought, God, it'd be perfect if I could have Chrome OS, which I love, and I love my Pixel, and had a Linux command line on it. And this guy, David Schneider, is a Google hardware engineer, figured out how to do it. We're gonna croutonize your Chromebook.
I'll show everybody how to turn my Chromebook into a crouton.
Yes,
is that what you're saying?
Exactly.
All right.
A couple of call for helps and so forth. But first, the hot topics. And you and I both are Android lovers. And you do it for a living.
Yeah. It's a big part of what I do, for sure.
I do it because it's fun and I enjoy them. And Of course, part of what we have to do is keep track of all the latest Android devices. And unlike the iPhone, where there's one every year, there's probably a new Android device every few months.
Yeah, that makes it really difficult if you're an Android lover, because then you always want the next best thing, and you're not just waiting that year.
Right.
You're every 2-3 months something's coming out and making you question the decision that you just made.
Question. So we're going to help you kind of bust through these questions and decide. I've been saying that the Galaxy S7 from Samsung is the best Android device out there.
It is
for so
fantastic.
Many reasons. It's a great processor. It's fast. Samsung's OLED screens are the best. Camera's the best. Remarkable. But it's also the easiest to break, because both you and I, you can see the big crack in mine.
Yeah.
You broke yours as well. And
yeah,
a big
you can
crack
put it up side
yours.
By side. I don't know if
yeah.
you can
because it's
see it there
basically
up at the top.
I have
nice
the Edge.
Cracks up there.
You have the standard Galaxy
goodness.
S7.
Yes.
The Edge is like a slippery little fish.
It's
made out of glass.
That's true. It's slippery.
Like, whoa.
And it's also one thing that I've noticed about the S7 series, both the Edge and just the standard S7, is that the bezel isn't extending further than the glass necessarily around the entire edge. So what you get is you get raised glass above everything
right.
else. So literally, this fell out of my pocket. For anyone who hasn't heard the story already, I was sitting cross-legged on my floor at home.
And it
was
leaked.
In my pocket.
It leaked
and it
out of your
slid,
pocket.
It slid yeah. out of my pocket, maybe fell, I don't know, about this far to the floor. And that's even generous. And it cracked in three places.
Mine
that's
only cracked here. But still, you know, it's the problem is when we first got these, we didn't have cases. I now have a mil-spec case from UAG that's going to protect it from now on.
But and your crack is on the back, so that covers it up.
Back.
You don't even know.
You're going to replace yours.
Yeah, we're getting the screen replaced.
Meanwhile, HTC, who we've liked a lot for a long time, they did the really great HTC One M7 and the M8, came out with an aluminum
M10
phone, Android phone, running also Marshmallow and the Snapdragon 820 processor. This is their HTC 10. So you and I have both reviewed it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've been living with the HTC 10 for about a week and a half now as my primary device, and I certainly have some thoughts, especially in comparison with the S7, because it really feels like they're on the same battleground.
These are head to head.
Yes, for sure.
It's almost like if you like Samsung, get the Samsung. If you like HTC, get the HTC. Mm-hmm. They're that close.
Yeah.
But there are still pros and cons.
They're similar in some ways. They definitely speak a different design language, as you can kind of see right off the top. The HTC 10 has that kind of aluminum backing, and I prefer that to the exposed glass on the back of the device. I just feel like that makes the device instantly less durable long term.
It also reminds one a little bit of the beautiful HTC One, which I was a big fan of, although the bezels are a lot deeper than they were on the old HTC.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have one thing I loved about the HTC One, which is the dual front-facing speakers. I'm surprised they abandoned that.
Yeah, well, they do have two speakers. It's just one's on top.
Right. That's your phone speaker.
And then one's underneath, shooting, you know, outwards, which if you're, you know, depending on where your phone is, that's going to be muffled. It's going to be cupped, you know, with your hand, depending on how you're holding it.
This is the quote subwoofer, and this is the tweeter.
I'm pretty sure on any device that's this thin, you don't actually have
it's
a subwoofer. Yeah, there is no such thing as
it's
rumbling lows.
Butt shaker.
On speakers like this. But I like its durability. I like that it has less glass and that it actually does have the lip on the bezel for me because I've now shattered two screens. I went from going years of never dropping a device and shattering a screen to two within a year.
Yeah.
So there it goes. Less UI clutter, although I put Google Now Launcher on here. And I think the testament to how scaled back HTC Sense is now versus what it used to be is you put Google Now Launcher on there.
And it's pretty plain, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, even notification pane is really just pretty standard for the most part. Where you really see the enhancements is when you go into the settings. And even there, it's like they took what you expect to see and maybe removed some like separating lines and did a couple of additions. But pretty close to stock.
Yeah, I've never been a fan of some of the apps that Samsung has to its Galaxy phones. Like the S Voice, I disabled that immediately.
Yeah.
But I have kind of become a little used to the settings pane and the quick settings pane. And I miss that a little bit. I do like,
you do like
TouchWiz's quick settings. They're configurable. They're right there. It's easy to change those. That's missing on the HTC. But, you know, Samsung did something pretty much unacceptable. They flipped the back and Recents button on this phone, mm-hmm. whereas it's traditionally placed on the HTC 10. And I got to give them points for that. Also, even though the home button on the HTC 10 is a physical home button, it what's nice about it is it doesn't move. Mm-hmm. That's your fingerprint reader on both phones.
I have noticed that depending on the size of your thumb, like sometimes when I go to unlock it, because these capacitive buttons are on the side, it will go.
You'll hit those.
It'll trigger those along with it, and that can be a little inconvenient, but that's minor.
Nexus phones have all of the controls on screen. None of them are physical controls. And that's probably the right way to do it.
That's how I'm pretty used to it. One thing I do not like about the HTC 10, and I realize this is a totally limited use case, but it's one thing that would almost kill this phone for me, is that if you have any sort of polarized lenses, say you wear sunglasses that are polarized, this will basically, when you hold it portrait, it kills the display entirely.
Oh,
you can see
terrible.
Absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
So if I'm out in the sun with this device and I'm wearing my sunglasses, many people have polarized lenses, I can't see anything. I have to take my sunglasses off, and it's really inconvenient.
Well, that's a larger point because the HTC is an IPS LCD screen. Samsungs are Super AMOLEDs. I really prefer the Super AMOLED. Even if you set brightness aside and you can see the Samsung, which is on your screen left, is brighter. I think the colors are more accurate. The blacks are blacker. Mm-hmm. The whites are whiter. I do prefer the Samsung. I think they make the best screens out there.
Mm-hmm.
So for screen, we've got to give pride of place to the Samsung Galaxy.
Also got to give it to the camera. Camera on the
camera's
S7 is pretty phenomenal.
And they're very similar. You know, this is the HTC 10 is using the same sensor as in the Google 6P. It's a nice big pixel sensor with phase focusing built in.
Laser focus.
Laser focusing as well. I find the focusing, even though it's laser, is not as fast.
Yeah.
It takes a while to focus on the HTC 10. I don't even notice it focusing on the F7.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that while both give excellent images, I think the S7 gets a slightly better image.
I would agree. How's your battery life been on the 10?
S7 is a clear winner on that. Now, both of them get through the day. So, I mean, both of them are better, and I think that's because of Marshmallow Android 6, than these phones used to be, much better than the S6 or the HTC 1. But this one is, I'm getting 17, 18, 20 hours pretty regularly on the S7. And I got to say, that's maybe the most important thing for me.
For sure.
I do miss the fact that, and I'm sad about the fact that Samsung elected to use, probably because of their Gear VR headsets, the old, same old micro USB port on theirs. I can't wait till everybody's gone to Type-C connectors as the HTC has. That's a great connector, and it's everywhere.
I completely agree. I will say along that line, though, and it's kind of a negative, is, you know, one of the things that we really like about USB, the way it's been, is that, you know, we've collected all of these chargers over the years, right?
Yeah.
So the charger packs, the cables, they always fit, and they always seem to work. Well, with USB-C, there's different types of fast charging. So, for example, my 6P charger and USB-C cable will charge this very slowly.
Right.
Which I didn't realize this the first time. I plugged it in, went back to it a couple hours later, and it was like 5% increase. I was like, wow, that is really slow.
It's the new Qualcomm
so there's a little bit of
3
difference.
Fast charging. So
you got to be
use
aware
their
of it
charger or a high amperage charger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have wireless charging. I really miss that. I love the fact that the S7, I just keep it on my wireless charger.
Yeah, that's a luxury that's I have not explored personally very much. But people who have it, love it.
But these are all minor differences.
Yeah.
This is a very competent feature phone. It's a little less expensive, isn't it, than the...
Yes.
I think it's like $100 less than the S7.
Yeah, and I mean, I even got it for $100 less than that because when they first launched it, they launched it at $100 off for a short time.
That's a compelling argument if price is an issue for you.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm going to stick with the Galaxy S7. When you get yours fixed, what do you think?
Man, I don't know. And I mean, beyond that, it's really hard for me to stray from the Nexus devices because that's just what I'm used to. But between these two, I probably would end up sticking with the 10 personally.
There you go.
Only because durability is pretty important to me these days. I do not want to crack a third screen in a year, so I kind of feel like I have better chances with the 10.
They're both excellent phones. Either one you'd be happy to have.
Absolutely.
If I broke my S7, I'd carry the HTC 10 with proud happiness, and I would be satisfied with it. But given the choice, I think I'm going to keep a good case on my S7 and use that one. I like that phone.
Fantastic.
There you go. So some good phones, and I expect we'll hear more about Android N on Wednesday, right? You're going to Google I.O. We'll be covering the keynote live.
Yep.
What do you think?
Well, so it's different this year in the sense that we already kind of know the Android release. Usually when Google I.O. is coming up, you don't really know a whole lot about the next release of Android. You go there, they reveal everything for you. Well, they did that a couple of months ago with some developer previews, early developer previews. So we know a lot. But the rumors are basically pointing to the fact that we don't know everything. For example, virtual reality is a big deal right now.
We've heard
a lot of leaks around virtual reality.
We've
and Google.
Seen in the databases, you know, in the benchmarks and everything, and we've seen in the code base, there is probably a standalone Android VR device. You know,
right.
They did Google Cardboard a couple of years ago. Samsung's been making the Gear VR that requires a Samsung phone. You think Google will make one that has Android built in?
Yeah, well, I think what we've been hearing is that they are going to be working VR into the Android experience somewhere on the OS level, support for it at the very least.
Okay.
So I think, yes, we're going to hear, I'm guessing, a little bit of that baked into N. I'm hoping, I imagine, especially if the rumors about a standalone hardware are true. But Google's approach apparently is not going to rely on the phone. It's not going to rely on being tethered to a computer. It's going to be a completely standalone VR, helmet.
I think we'll see a lot of VR stuff because Google's been beefing up their VR division. They introduced, the Google Cardboard, but they've been really kind of scooped by Facebook and Samsung and HTC. They've all done their helmets. Where's Google's?
Right.
They have a big investment in Magic
Leap.
They were
in early, but...
Yeah, well, we'll see. Well, I think we'll see some announcements.
Mm-hmm.
What will N stand for?
Oh, boy. I never know the...
I'm not telling you is what Hiroshi Lockheimer said.
Right,
I'm not telling you.
So that means that Nutella's out of the question. They're not going to do a branded one, I'm guessing.
I'm hoping not.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Nougat. Nougat tends
Nougat's not nut.
Yeah.
I'm thinking nut roll. I'm telling you. I know everybody
poo-poos
that.
Oh, so you're going down the nut road.
I like the nut roll. I think nut. Somebody's saying nut or butter. I don't know.
I'm not sure. I just
Fluffer nutter.
Oh, sorry.
I don't know. It'll be N. That's all we know. It'll be the dessert that begins with N.
Yeah, Nutter Butter. That's
Neapolitan.
Good. That's good.
Nutter Butter. That'd be good. I like
that. The point is we have absolutely no
idea.
And we might not even find out at Google I.O., but I'd be very surprised if after it being out for a couple of months, they don't finally use that as a reason to announce
it. Our coverage starts 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 1700 UTC. Wednesday morning, we'll be streaming the keynote live and covering it. Who's going to be sitting with me? It'll be me. I can't remember. We got great people. And then we'll do Windows Weekly right after that. And then that'll give us a couple of hours for you, Jeff Jarvis.
Yes.
Father Roberts. There are all the people who are at the Google event to find somewhere. I think we got somewhere. I think Chris DeBona's arranging somewhere for us to be on campus.
We might be on the Googleplex. Yeah.
Which means we'll also hear maybe from Matt Cutts and some other
folks. I'm sure.
So we'll do that live coverage. It'll be almost all day except for that little Windows Weekly slice in the middle there on Wednesday for
Google
Cool,
I can't
I.
wait. Oh, I always look forward to Google I.O. It's always a lot of fun.
Yeah. We have a couple other stories, but I think we're running out of time. I just want maybe an update. We talked with the Kepler folks, remember, from NASA a couple of weeks ago? They have found some planets. the largest collection of planets ever discovered. Wow. I mean,
and
they've already found hundreds.
I mean,
it's amazing.
What was it? They had 1,200 that they had discovered before the announcement, and then in one single announcement, an additional 1,200.
They've doubled the number of planets.
Yeah.
So that really means that it seems very likely that there are some habitable planets out there, that there's somewhere else life could have arisen, and maybe we could go visit someday if we get some really
or
fast
someone
rocket
could.
Ships.
Yeah. Do you think we're going to visit in our lifetime?
Our lifetime? No. It would take our lifetime to get there.
All right.
Yep. Not going
to
happen.
I'm willing to take the plunge.
Not going to happen. All right. We'll skip the $100 3D printer that went wrong. Kickstarters going wrong is always a favorite of mine. You didn't put money into this, did
you? No, I didn't. There aren't many Kickstarters that I have put money into it. And as time goes on, you keep hearing about these kind of horror stories. I don't know. I think it's a problem for Kickstarter just in general, because the more we hear about these things, the more people are going to hesitate in putting their money in on projects.
I had put money into a mug that Steve Gibson flogged. It was supposed to come in summer of 2014. Mm-hmm. Steve just got his.
Oh,
so
good.
Never give up. Never give up. I think this 3D printer.
Then it's like you're getting a gift at that point.
Yeah,
you've
right.
pretty much
like,
kissed
wow.
the money goodbye at that point.
Wow. It's, they weren't making it up. This one, do you think is a scam? Show the video of the 3D. This is the... What is it called? The Peachy?
The Peachy printer. It's a $100 3D printer.
So let me introduce David Bowen.
And it went wrong.
Okay, when you see a post on the Kickstarter page, really bad news.
Yes. After not many updates for the last year and a half,
these guys say one of the partners took off with the money and built a house.
Well, yeah, so they raised more than $600,000 on this project. And after the project was a success, the co-founder, the guy on the left that you see there, finally, eventually admitted to taking more than $320,000 to build a house. Over the course, you know, the person on the right, the founder,
didn't build a printer.
They basically chose not to tell the backers because they wanted to try and figure out other avenues to kind of recoup the project and eventually deliver the product. And over the course of the past year and a half, nobody knew this. And it's like a series of unfortunate events, one after the other. They updated their site.
I can't believe
he's
not punching him right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's part of what has people wondering, like, is this really a discovery? Or was this the plan? Was this just a really creative way to, unload $600,000 from a bunch of people's pockets?
Well, we're hearing more and more of this. Did you see this week that one of the engineers at U-Beam, a lot of people asked me about U-Beam. This was going to be wireless phone charging. It would be great, right?
Yeah.
You just put a U-Beam device in your house and your phone just magically gets more power.
All right.
I thought, that doesn't sound feasible.
Right.
Apparently, we're using very high frequency or inaudible sound waves. Maybe they're very low. I don't know. Mm-hmm. To generate electricity. Anyway, the engineer behind it said he had an anonymous, originally blog post called Lies. Actually, the blog is called Lies, Damn Lies, and Startup PR. He was anonymous, but it finally was revealed that he, in fact, was the one of the chief engineers at U-Beam. He's been in a little bit of a fight with one of their chief investors who says, no, it's going to work. He says, yeah, I don't think so.
Yeah.
So be careful where you put your money, folks.
I think so. I think the
internet's given a whole new life to scammers.
Mm-hmm.
More they can do than ever before.
And unintentional loss of major amounts of money. You know, even if people aren't intentionally scamming,
right.
A lot of times they're starting these big projects, pie in the sky. They've got a really good idea, but executing on that idea is a much different story. And I think that's a big, thing around the kind of the Peachy printer failure. But I think that's just one isolated example, and we see a lot of that.
So, you don't mind, I just wiped out your Chromebook.
But I love you, Chromebook.
I had mine at home, but I thought, well, you got one here. So I just wiped it completely, put it in developer mode, and we're going to show you how to put Linux on it in just
a
second.
Sounds good.
But first,
sounds
it's good. Time for a call for help. Rocky, Cincinnati, Ohio. Hello, Rocky.
Hey, Rocky.
How's it going, guys?
Wow, do you live in a library?
No, I just like books, a lot of books.
I like books,
I thought
too.
Maybe they were DVDs, like you was a
no,
video
No, that's
store.
The library downstairs next to the television.
All right. you're big into high-quality physical media, eh?
Yeah, I kind of like to keep track of the books. You know, if the power's out, it's and your phone runs out, what are you going to do?
Yeah. Well, what can we do for you?
Well, I have
By the way, don't ever say
twins.
Power runs out, phone runs out to me, because I get a chill. Like this, I go.
There's always batteries, right?
Yeah, go ahead. You have a media collection.
No, my problem is I have 7-month-old twins.
Oh, that's a child collection.
Oh,
also, you're growing a new baby collection. You're growing.
Why do one when you get two for twice the price?
Exactly.
The only time I can get onto my computer or on to watch some television or get on crossed onto my brand new ham radio license.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I'm really excited about it. The problem is the kids sleep in the room right next to me.
Uh-oh.
So headphones are a must.
Yeah.
What I want to be able to do is put my computer, my laptop, my television, and my new radio all on one set of headphones that work simultaneously so I'm not having to flip back and forth or accidentally screech out the entire house when I hit some random signal somewhere. Is there any advice you can give me as to how I can get those onto one device without costing me an arm and a leg?
You don't intend to watch TV and listen to music at the same time. You just want them all on one thing.
Right. Well, I can be watching television and then my Skype goes off on my computer or I get a communicator message off of my work laptop.
And you don't want to have to juggle your headphones between four sources.
Yeah. Right. I don't want to miss a call because I'm listening to my radio or vice versa.
Sure.
Well, you're the audio guru.
Well, I did some poking around, and I mean, really, ultimately what it sounds like you need is some sort of a headphone audio mixer. At that point, you need something that's capable of four inputs. I found a Rolls MX-51S. Tried to keep it on the lower end of cost. So that's $55. And what this gives you is four discrete channels with one headphone output.
This is great.
And three of those channels actually are RCA inputs. And I was thinking about kind of your audio sources. And I would imagine, an RCA to like eighth inch headphone jack would work for your laptop. And I'm not sure what would work with your TV, but maybe something similar. But you can,
same thing.
Yeah, you can get kind of the conversion cables if you need to. There is a fourth input that's an XLR. And you said that one of these is for the ham stuff that you're doing. I'm not entirely sure because I'm not a ham. But does that audio source come out as XLR? I mean, if not, you could do a conversion with a cable. But there you go. You'd have that as your fourth input.
Yeah, I haven't exactly bought my radio yet because, twins, I don't have, the thousands of dollars I need. So I can probably find something that'll work with that, or I'm sure there's an adapter somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure. Mm-hmm. And do you watch Ham Nation, our ham show?
Was one of the reasons I got my license, yes.
Oh, that's great. So you got to figure Bob Heil, sitting in his beautiful radio shack with all these different radios, is not going to take off the headphones and go over to the other one, put that headphone, do that. He's got a mixer in there. Yep. And I think that that's the simplest way. And you notice each input has different volumes. So you could turn the Skype one real low so
you can mix it.
Jump out of your seat. You know what? I will ask Bob the next time I see him. I'll say, Bob, how do you do it? I bet you he has a mixer. Of course, knowing Bob, he built it himself.
Right. And it's probably not a low kind of profile mixer. No. It's probably capable of doing a lot more.
But with analog inputs, and that was all analog inputs, mm-hmm. I think that it doesn't need to be a fancy, mm-hmm. expensive mixer.
Agreed.
Ham Nation 36, they do talk about connecting an audio mixer to your transmitter. I would guess that's probably going to have some information in there. About that.
Wow.
It's very similar, what he's doing with multiple radios, mm-hmm. very similar to what you're doing.
Yep.
Yeah, and I try to keep it low profile, right?
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, I like the one you just showed. That $55 and then
it's a desktop thing. You do something a little bit larger, then you end up with all these sliders and everything. And I just don't know if you necessarily need that. Right. Have a nice little tight box. You just pop the headphone into the output and adjust the individual levels for each of your sources, and you're done.
And for bonus geek points, I can just hook it up to my Bluetooth adapter as well.
Absolutely. Hey, Rocky, great to talk to you. Congratulations on the twins. What are their names?
Thank you. Their names are Charlotte and Dennis. We call them Russell or Rusty. They are 7 months old, so as you can imagine, right now my wife is doing me a big favor by trying to keep them wrangled downstairs. So.
But I will say, 7 months, you're slowly coming out of the fog.
Yeah.
You're like, this is slowly what real life is like. I remember this. Slowly.
I'm sleeping through the night.
Yes,
I'm getting
little bits.
I did that last night. It was the first time in a while.
Yes. That's a win.
Congratulations, Rocky. It's great.
Thank you.
Nice to talk to you.
Yes.
Same to you.
I really appreciate all you guys do. I've been watching since I was taping it on my VCR.
What are your call signs?
It is KE8DZS.
KE8DZS, W6TWT. We'll see you on the airwaves when you get a radio.
Eventually, right.
You don't have time for ham for a few more years, I think.
No.
Take care. It's good to talk to
you.
Thanks, Rocky.
Take care.
Coming up, Ian Thompson next week is our host, and Ian's a great guy. I'm sure
he's awesome.
You can ask him about British swearing, whatever it is you want.
He's almost always guaranteed to come out with at least one or two words during a broadcast that you've never heard before.
But it's useful
for
future.
And potentially
slangful. A weird British guy.
Yes.
Here's how you can ask a question on the show.
Need tech help? The new screensavers are here with answers. Email your tech questions to newscreensavers@twit.tv.
You know what every father of twin 7 months old should have?
Oh.
An Audible subscription. You got to go out and get an Audible subscription. Because the thing is, in fact, you should probably get one before they're born. The thing is, I love reading. He obviously loves reading. I'm sure you love to read, but a lot of times you're doing stuff, holding babies, mm-hmm. driving the car, on the treadmill. You're doing stuff where you can't read, you can't hold a book, but you could always listen to an Audible book. So let's get another channel on that mixer for his Audible books. I'm going to get you a free book right now when you go to audible.com/NSS. I am listening to the latest Peter F. Hamilton book. That was one Steve Gibson recommended, The Abyss Beyond Dreams, the first of another great science fiction trilogy. It is awesome. In fact, any of the Peter F. Hamilton books, and there are a lot of them on audible.com, would be fantastic. It's not just Peter F. Hamilton. I mean, they have all science fiction for many of the greats. One of the things they've done, they've got this Audible Frontiers program. They're recording classic science fiction for people like Robert Heinlein and Isaac Asimov, books that, you know, came out in the pulp era of science fiction, so they were never recorded. They're making new audio recordings of them with their Audible Frontiers. So it's a great chance to go back, read all of Dune, for instance. They've, of course, got all the bestsellers, mysteries, but a lot of nonfiction, too. I'm reading biographies. I'm reading the Alexander Hamilton biography, the George Washington biography. I love biographies. Oh, that's the new Hamilton. This is the story of the Broadway show. Look, you can get any one of these books absolutely free when you go to audible.com/NSS. Now, the key on this is you're going to be signing up for the Gold Plan. That's a book a month. You also get the Daily Digest of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, your pick. But you pay nothing for the first 30 days. So you can cancel any time in that first month, and that book is going to be yours no matter what. You will have paid nothing. I don't think you're going to cancel. But I think you want to try it, because I think, you know, some people I know are skeptical. Will I be able to listen to a book? Will I hear everything? You know, am I going to get distracted? So try it.
It's hard to go back.
It's hard to go back. Yeah. You're going to get sucked into it. Yeah. And I tell you, if you have a commute of any kind, there's nothing better. Mm-hmm. Audible.com/NSS. Your first book's free. Try it today. So this is it.
Yes, almost a year in the
making. Beautiful. Tell us how the genesis of this project.
Well, I can't remember the episode exactly, but it was an episode of Twig almost a year ago. I think the title is Aaron's Arcade, because Newcomb was on.
Yeah, yeah.
And he brought in his own bar top arcade machine
and showed it off.
And, you know, he had built it. Aaron's a maker. He likes to tweak, you know, all these things and make it to his own specifications.
And you wanted to do it, I remember.
I made a random offhanded comment during the show, like, man, I've always wanted one of those things. Someday maybe I'll do it. Well, a woodworker fan of the network, Diami Palatki from the East Coast, reached out to me shortly after, and he was like, hey, I work with wood, and I'd be happy to work with you on this project. I will do it. If you're interested. And I mean, what am I going to say? No, I'm not interested in getting an arcade.
He did it. I mean, look at the inlay. This is a beautiful kind of bird's eye maple with incredible grain.
I mean, excellent finish. I mean, the finish quality is super shiny, super slick. I love it. I mean, I love it.
Like, so you did the guts and he did the glory, so to speak.
Yeah, so, you know, he's a busy guy. He's got a full-time job. He's also got a lot of woodworking projects and everything. So,
he does a podcast, right? Very good woodworking podcast.
Yeah, and so, you know, he's used to taking on these projects and doing them, and life is just kind of crazy. So it took a little bit of time, but we got there. And I was, you know, we were just always very patient, because we knew in the end, when it happened, it was just going to be an incredible gift.
So tell us a little bit about the insides here.
Well, we've got a Raspberry 2 powering all of this.
Okay. And that's enough power for this.
Yeah, and it's running RetroPie, which is basically a system image that Aaron Newcomb, I've spent some time with Aaron Newcomb a couple of days ago once we finally got this in-house. And Aaron and I just kind of, you know, popped the machine upside down and really got to the cables. There it is, all sprawled out on the table, actually. Everything before we got started. You can see the controls
underneath.
You
can order those all online?
The U-Track roller pad. Got that off of eBay, got a few things off of Amazon, got a monitor off of Amazon, pieced it all together. I probably spent close to around $450 on parts.
You know, we had a MAME machine when we first started in the studio 5 years ago that was powered by a Mac Mini. The Mini alone would have cost more than that.
Right. Yes.
So that's a pretty good price.
I mean, thinking about it, just the Pi itself, right? Like the Raspberry Pi, what is it,
$35?
And this is the Raspberry Pi 2. Of course, this is a newer version now. And if I want to...
You could upgrade it for $35.
I could upgrade
bucks.
It, and that gives me Bluetooth. And that might be great for, like, external Bluetooth controllers.
I love how this is all mounted. Look at that. It's
beautiful. So, you know, that's a speaker, basically a desktop speaker that was taken apart. Diami took it apart and, you know, sealed the speakers to the grills on the wood. and put the, you know, the this, controls
this
for it on
Dell
the
Dell monitor. Now, Kara, come around back, because I think you're off at an angle, which means you're not going to see how crisp and clear it is. But if you shoot straight on, this is a beautiful monitor. This was an inexpensive monitor, though?
I paid close to $100 for it.
Really,
I could have
nice.
Gone less expensive, but I was like, you know, at that point, like, you're saving $20 or whatever. And I went. I made sure, you can notice, it's 4:3. So
yeah,
I made sure to do 4:3 because
important.
All the old school
they're
kind of retro games are all 4:3.
TV stuff.
And I didn't want to have to deal with black bars.
But this is a nice, this actually looks better than those games ever looked.
Yeah,
in the,
you know,
the
some
arcade.
Purists are going to say CRT all the way because
right.
you get the
no,
scan lines
no,
and all
no,
that kind
no,
of stuff.
No, 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 I don't want scan lines. Can we play a game while you're talking, or is it going to distract you?
No, go for
let's
it.
Let's play Tetris. I mean,
should
we
might
play?
Distract me a little bit, but that's okay. So let's
good.
See
I want
so
you to be distracted. You beat
we'll go
me
ahead and fire thing. Off Tetris. Uh-oh. Oh, well, there we go. I guess I'll go sideways.
You have to shoot. You have
so
to sideways.
We've got the coin. The coin drops here. We both have them.
Oh, look.
And
all
then,
right. So you could actually. You don't have a mechanism. But
oh, yeah. No,
people,
that's a that's a touch
money
that Diami put in there.
I
he
like
was like,
that.
"I've got these. Do you want me to put them on?"
Yeah, thanks, Diami.
So we'll go ahead and oh, that's right. We'll do this.
Oh,
and here
oh,
we go.
How come you're beating me already? Oh, wait.
Well, I think it's the...
Okay.
There we go.
All right.
It's
we don't even know how to play.
The how to play.
Now, this looks really good, but this is the same game as... do we have Diami on the phone?
Yes, we do.
Oh! Hi, Diami!
Hi, Leo.
Oh, man, you did a beautiful job on this thing. This is
thank you.
Gorgeous. How long... I remember we talked to you 6 months ago, and you were building it at that time. So how long did it take total?
In raw hours, it's probably in the ballpark of 50 to 70 hours.
Wow. And are the plans online anywhere for this?
Yeah, it's
well, for this exact one for Jason, there are no plans other than what's in my head. but what I did was the one that Aaron made that inspired Jason was on Instructables.
Okay.
So right. I followed his plans, and then I actually had to widen it a little bit to fit the rollerball, which isn't in the original.
This thing is right. huge.
Yeah, the original plans did not have the rollerball, and I really wanted to figure out how we could get a rollerball in there because I'm a huge fan of Marble Madness. It's like one of my all-time favorite games, arcade games. And Diami was like, yeah, I think we can make that work. And so I believe, Diami, you kind of tweaked things to kind of widen it a little bit so that it would make room for that in the middle.
Exactly. That's one of the reasons I had you send me all of the controllers before I started building was to make sure that they would all fit.
Right.
So I took the plans that had all the buttons and physically laid that out, and then literally just cut it and spread it apart till I could fit the rollerball in the middle.
Oh, man, you won. That's because I've been stacking.
You're distracted.
I am distracted.
He's distracted.
I'm about to stop.
Look at this. So it looks like, is that a sander? And what kind of tools? Are these fairly typical tools you're using? Or
for woodworkers, they would be. That's a small router.
Oh, it's a router. That's how you made the holes.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, I did the holes with the drill press, but the rollerball has that black sleeve that retains the ball.
Yeah.
And the sleeve is not as deep as the thickness of the panel. So I actually had to remove wood on the back to make it flush.
How nice. What a beautiful job you did. And this feels like it's going to last a lifetime. Now, did you paint it? How did you do this?
No, it's a wipe-on urethane finish.
I love
it's just regular Minwax cut with mineral spirits.
And for the name Yellow Gold Mame, I love that. Jason's band is Yellow Gold. Did you draw that on? It looks really good. You're good at that. That looks good.
No, that's printed on.
Oh.
What I do is you print it onto like a...
Transfer.
A shipping label pack. You peel off all the shipping labels and you print on what's essentially wax paper.
Uh-huh.
And then you can actually... The ink doesn't set... And you can rub it onto the wood, and that's just printer ink on the wood.
So it's a tattoo, basically, and then you just seal that in with the urethane.
Right.
Look at that.
Right.
Jason, you get to keep this.
It's kind of crazy. It's one of those I'm not worthy moments.
I know how you feel.
How on earth, like, did this all come together? And Diami, I can't even thank you enough, man. Without your help and you reaching out to me, like, this would not exist. This is just amazing.
No problem. It was a joy to build.
Nice little touches too. I love the speaker grills
that
you put in here.
I mean, there's just so many touches throughout. Diami was also very. Very conscious, and you can probably explain it better than I can, but just about the fact that wood can expand and contract based on kind of the environment and weather and all that kind of stuff. Diami, you built in some kind of protection measures against that affecting the woodwork.
Yeah, the way you see all the grain is all oriented vertically, so it's all going to move together. And really, the only spot I was nervous about was that front section is going to widen and narrow as it expands and contracts. So the bottom is plywood. So that bottom plywood panel actually just floats there because it won't move. Right. So as it expands and contracts, the bottom piece will stay in place.
Yeah, we can't really see it here because it's underneath. It's up against the
exactly.
Table.
That's why I went with plywood, because you can't see it.
Mm-hmm. So the wood on here, is this maple?
It's curly maple. Mm-hmm. It's all the blonde wood. And then the darker sections are Purple Heart.
Beautiful. That Purple Heart is gorgeous. I love that inlay. It really makes it.
It's like racing stripes. I love it. It's got a nice character. It adds a nice character to it.
And this will age well, too, won't it? I mean, it's going to be... Your children's fingerprints will be all over this.
Someday in the future, there will be a Raspberry 25 inside.
I think so, and the grandkids will be playing on it. That's really neat. Well, I would love it if we could get some of the information on the website, but you said there are no plans for this, huh? You just made it up as you went along?
Yeah, I like I said, I used the plans from Instructables, and I think Jason will have that link, but I can certainly send it if you don't.
Yeah, we'll put that on
our
website.
And then from there, I changed it as I needed to fit the actual components that Jason had sent me.
Yeah, there's the original instructions.
Yeah, this is much
nicer. What it helps you create is just a two-player machine, more or less, without the trackball. So,
well, it's just I can tell you this, Diami. Every quarter that goes in here is going to go right back to you.
I'll put a little cup under there. It'll catch all the quarters. We'll just send it back to you for years to come.
Diami, tell us the name of your podcast.
It is the Modern Woodworkers Association.
And we can find that at?
ModernWoodworkersAssociation.com.
There you go.
Good choice.
Yeah. Absolutely must listen if you're into wood.
Hey, there it is.
And there. So you did a show on this as well. Good.
Yeah, I think you've been updating on it over the course of the many months that you've been working on it. So
look
that's
at that.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I'm looking.
Now, there's no guarantee you're going to get tech news today on this one. But you, early versions, you were able to get
it. It's a bonus upgrade.
Diami, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diami.
Appreciate it.
No problem.
Nice job.
It's a pleasure to work on the project. Thank you.
Nice job. What a great project.
I know. Oh. I know. Now, I will say I'm a little worried about tonight. Because I'm going to be carting this home, which is exactly what I want to do.
You're not walking down the street.
No. That's not the part that worries me.
I got a MAME cabinet here. Get out of my way.
The part that worries me is now that this is going to be in the house, keeping my two kids from wanting to do nothing but this forever and ever.
Keeping daddy's office. Daddy's work.
That doesn't exist. So we'll see what.
The good news is there's no Grand Theft Auto 4 on here, so I think you're all right.
No, there's a lot of wholesome games.
How many games are
there? Good question. Let's see here.
It goes forever.
There is a way to... Oh, man. I can't remember, but it's a couple thousand, I think.
Wow!
I mean, and then I can go, and skip between...
Oh, look, by category.
Atari 2600. Of course...
Oh, my gosh. All Dreamcast. Wait a minute. Go back. That's my game. That's my game.
Yeah, we don't really have
anything. We don't have any Gamecast games.
But I suppose it's capable.
I guess so. Look at that.
Anyways.
That was my favorite thing. My son asked the other day, who do we give our Dreamcast to, and can we get it back? So that was a long time ago. Henry.
Yeah. You have to go on eBay for that, I have a feeling.
Yeah. Yeah. It was running Windows CE, I believe, on the Dreamcast.
Pretty fantastic. I do want to put some LEDs in here and in here to kind of light them up a little bit.
Not done.
So, I've got ideas for projects of how to kind of improve it over time.
The yellow gold MAME cabinet. Yes. Thanks to Instructables and Diami Plotkey
and Aaron Newcomb,
who did a great job. Yeah.
He was here for a solid day, a couple of days ago.
He loves doing this stuff.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's a maker at heart, so
very nice.
He enjoys it.
Thank you, Jason. Well done.
Yeah. Thank you, Diami. Thank you.
I'm going to screw up your Chromebook in just a second, so hang on. Okay, we're not done doing that yet. But before we do that, I want to tell you about the journal. Kevin Rose was on last week, and he told us about this. He's doing a new monthly email letter. He picks the best stuff. He says, I spend much of the month researching this, and you can get it for free, www.thejournal.email. It's one of those new email domains. Remember, Kevin was the guy, the dark tipper on the screensavers, who always came up with great stuff, software to download. He founded Dig because he loved to hunt down and post the best stuff from around the web. And Dig Nation, remember, always had the best stories from Dig. And I think, Kevin's gone on to do other great things. He runs Hodinkee now, which is an incredible watch blog. But I think he always, kind of in his heart, wanted to keep telling people about cool new stuff he found. And he just needed an outlet for that, and that's why he's created the Journal. And you know what? He doesn't charge you for this. This is a labor of love. Get Kevin's take on the latest gadgets. He's doing all, you know, he did that cold, he's doing that cold thing, the body hacks he does. He has podcasts there, videos, style tips. Kevin only sends one newsletter a month. You're not going to be buried under mail from the Journal. So you can look forward to just a monthly newsletter, a pithy newsletter full of great newsworthy stuff. And by the way, he only recommends stuff he loves. It has his seal of approval. He tests it. He owns them. It's a newsletter for the curious. And don't forget to check out the podcast version of the Journal, too. He interviews people who are experts in their field. And Kevin's always been a great interviewer. Now over 50,000 members strong. I want you to sign up. No spam. Just a great monthly newsletter for the curious. TheJournal.email. TheJournal.email. And Kevin, congratulations on launching that. Congratulations on your success. And everybody should take a look at TheJournal.email. Chromebooks are getting better and better. Mm-hmm. Do you use... Now, this is your Chromebook Pixel. I have one at home, too. Do you use this as your day-to-day computer? I see it on the set.
Yeah, you know, that's a complicated question because I actually leave it here. So I use it for
all... It's your work computer.
It's my work computer. Yeah. And I do all my shows using the Chromebook Pixel. Ron Richards on All About Android thinks I'm crazy. But I'm used to it. Like, you know, I won't lie. It took a little bit of kind of getting used to. But now it's my preferred device for running a show here.
I'm going to make it even better.
All right.
Because, and this was a personal quest, you know, I really love this computer, but I felt a little limited by Chrome OS. It's just the Chrome browser, and you can only do things that are Chrome extensions.
Sure.
And in my mind, I said, you know, the only thing missing, if I could get a Linux command prompt on here, and I could use all the Linux stuff that I like, you know, just as an additional sideline, I'd feel pretty good about this. Now, early on with the Chromebook, a guy named David Schneider, who's a hardware engineer at Google, created a project called Crouton. It's a free open source project. And I tried it. I felt it was a little bit funky. And I hadn't tried it recently till people said to me, Leo, why would you go put Linux, as I did, by the way. You can, and I did wipe off my Chromebook and put Linux on it. But they said, why would you do that when you can get the benefits of Chrome OS and still have Linux on here? And so I said, all right, well, I'm going to check out Crouton again. It's Crouton. It stands for the Chromium OS Universal Chroot Environment. And chroot, the Unix command chroot, is really the key. This was created by Bill Joy in the early 90s as a way to run an operating system within an operating system, not as a virtualization, but really just kind of as an operating system running underneath another operating system. Mm-hmm. And so we're going to use chroot to actually put Linux and... Now, admittedly, there's not a huge hard drive in most Chromebooks, but the nice thing about Linux, it's fairly compact, just a few gigabytes, and you can use it in conjunction with Chrome very easily. So this is how you're going to do it. First of all, you're going to put your Chromebook in developer mode. On the Pixel, you press Escape, Refresh, and the Power. You'll get a reboot screen that looks kind of scary that says, oh, you want to... And you do Command-D when you hit that. It says, oh, no, you want to go in developer mode, and they warn you. You are reducing the security somewhat when you go into developer mode. And one of the reasons I love Chromebooks is how secure they are. They have secure boot. Mm-hmm. You can't modify a Chromebook at all. So that's why you have to put it in developer mode to do this. However, there are ways to make your chroot more secure. And, the advantages of having a flexible system kind of maybe outweigh the security issue. You'll have to decide for yourself. The beauty part of this is all the things I've done to your Chromebook Pixel here can be wiped out with a power wash. So as soon as we're done with this, I'm just going to reboot it, get out of developer mode. It'll wipe everything off. Developer mode does wipe everything off. It'll wipe everything off again. You'll log in, and it'll be back the way it was.
Yeah.
No harm, no foul. Mm-hmm. That's Chrome
OS is
good reason.
Like that.
So you're going to download. What I did find, first of all, is there is a command line in every Chromebook. You press Control, Alt, and T, and that brings you to something called Croche, which is the Chrome OS developer shell. Let's make the text a little bit bigger so you can read it. If you got here by mistake, don't panic. Just close this tab and carry on. This is a tab within Chrome. And once you're in developer mode, you can then exit out by using the shell command, and you're going to actually get a root command at the shell. Now I'm running a sort of a shell. There's some commands you have. And in fact, you can see the operating system. This is one of the dirty little secrets, maybe not dirty, maybe the happy, shiny little secrets of Chrome OS is it's Linux. It's just a modified Linux running Chrome on top of it. It's the Chromium project. But we can get into the Linux and install, using chroot, another full Linux. And I've taken the liberty of putting Debian on here using Crouton. So let me go backwards a few steps through the command line. The first thing you're going to do is download Crouton, and you're going to get it from David's GitHub page on Crouton. If you just Google Crouton, you'll find it immediately. It'll be the first link. Google, by the way, approves of this. It's okay. You're allowed to do it. It's your hardware. And there are a lot of ways you can do it. Now, in the early days, it was Ubuntu, and it was XFCE. And that was the very simple way of doing this on a Chromebook. And as time's gone by, people have contributed to the Crouton project, and now you can install a larger variety of distributions. In fact, we can see which distributions if we go back to our shell. And we list, I'll do dash F, which is first of all, we can show you the different commands. There's quite a few commands that you have available, including if you want to have a GNOME desktop or a command line only desktop. I actually just put the command line on here, but if you don't mind, you can install a full desktop, and now it's GNOME as well as XFCE and even Unity, the Ubuntu desktop. You can also see what distributions you can have on there. What is I thought
XBMC.
It was XBMC can go on there. I guess I'm not sure why I'm not seeing that. But among other distributions, there is Ubuntu, but there's also Debian. Once you download Crouton, you can then run it in such a way that you're going to, in this case, I downloaded Jesse, which is the kind of stable version of Debian. This is the one I like. And you can install it with GNOME on here. Whoops, I didn't mean to do that. You can install it with GNOME on here. You can install utilities and stuff. And once I've installed that, and it does. I'm not going to do it in real time. You'll follow the very simple explanation David has on his GitHub. Once you've done that, you've actually got an entire Debian distribution on here, or Ubuntu, or whatever you install. You enter the chroot using this command. And I did one other thing, which I recommend you do, which is encrypt it. That way, it's as secure as a pretty standard Linux. And I'm actually now in Linux here. And so I can run Linux commands. I can download. You've got apt-get as one of your commands, because I'm using Debian, and I can install Emacs if I want. And I can even run an X window. Mm-hmm. There's an extension that allows me to not only run this in a tab, but to run this in a browser tab, individual Linux applications. So there are people using this as a digital audio workstation. I mentioned that because you're a musician. You can actually run all the Linux tools, and there's some very good Linux sound tools in here. You could run, of course, OpenOffice. You can even play Minecraft on here. I know a lot of kids get Chromebooks for school. Using Crouton and installing a Linux, you could actually run Minecraft on your... And we're still, by the way, we're still... I'm not going to quit that. We're still here in a standard Chrome OS environment. We haven't given that up.
So you're not dual booting or anything?
You're not dual booting, and that's the beauty of it. It's just running underneath.
That is nice.
Yeah.
It's always nice to have the option for something like that. I don't personally, in my day-to-day, I think the closest I get to Linux is when I, do ADB commands, on Android or something along those lines, as far as working with the line there. But so I don't know when I would need to hop in there. I'm curious to know what you do with Linux on Chrome.
There's a lot of, for instance, I like to use Emacs, of all things. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of tools that I like to use. One of the distributions you could put on here is Kali, which is a pen testing / hacker distribution of Linux that has all the pen test applications you'd like to do penetration testing on the network. So having a Chromebook that's running Chrome OS in a nice secure environment that's simple and easy to use, but then you open a shell and suddenly you're running Kali Linux and able to do the pen testing you want to do, that really makes this incredibly useful. And the best part is Chromebooks are inexpensive. Now this one's a $1,000 Chromebook.
Yeah.
But you can get them for $300. Acer, Dell, HP all have nice high quality Chromebooks for under $500. And when you get one with more storage, because you'd like to have 64 gigs so you have room for your Linux distribution. Oh, that's one other thing, is you can have many cheroots. So you could have a command line, you could have GNOME, you could have XFCE. As long as you've got enough hard drive space, you can have as many different versions of the operating system on there and load which one you want at any given time. And that's pretty impressive as well. Easy to create, easy to delete. And if you just get tired of it, you can power wash it out. I think Linux is a great thing to know. I think if you're somebody who wants to do programming, Python, Rust, C, whatever it is you like to do, having that on your laptop is important. It's one of the things you can't really do very well with Chrome OS. Now you can do it, and you have all of that power on here. So take a look at Crouton. I have to say, I had dismissed it after using it early on a couple of years ago when the Chromebooks first came out. But in the intervening time, it's gotten more and more powerful. You can back up your installation. That's what I do to a remote server so that I can always get back to it. I could power wash this and be up and running again in just a few minutes. It's the amount of time it takes to download it.
Yeah, it doesn't take long.
Pretty nice, pretty nice. So I'm going to power wash this off again, so that you don't have to put up with this. All you have to do is reboot and not go into developer mode. You'll be back to the way you were. But I encourage people to take a look at it. It's a simple, easy thing to do. Hey, coming up in just a second. Actually, why don't we do it now? Is Julian here? Can we do it now? Should we cross over there or do it right here? All right. We want to talk about the end of the world. So, you know,
great.
What better time?
Peachy.
Okay, not the end of the world, just the end of California. Julian Lozos is on the line. He's a professor of geophysics at Cal State University. We've talked to him before. He's at CSU Northridge. That name Northridge might ring a bell. That's the last time there was a big quake in California. It was the Northridge quake. Right, Julian?
Well, not the last time, but the last one that actually caused a substantial loss of life. Certainly.
Oh, yeah. There's earthquakes every day here. I mean,
that falls directly under where I'm sitting.
Oh, how nice for you. That makes it easy to study, doesn't it? But you're not...
I do your models. I can study.
You're not here to talk about the Northridge quake. You're here to talk about the world-famous San Andreas Fault. Is that the San Andreas Fault you're on?
So it's not. So California has, as you said, like thousands of faults, and the San Andreas is actually it's a bit east of here. So it does not run through L.A. And so the fault that caused the Northridge earthquake, we didn't know about until that happened, and it has since gotten the very creative name of the Northridge Fault.
Well, that's exciting. I mean, we're learning. It's kind of scary that we're learning about faults by having them erupt. You were the one, we had you on, who discovered the Cascadian Fault Zone, which...
Well, I didn't discover it. I definitely have not actually discovered any faults.
I'm shocked. I'm disappointed in you. I think you're a slacker.
Models of what they might do now that they've been discovered.
Now that we know about it, the Cascadian Fault was, when you were here, you scared everybody. In fact, there was a big article about it. The real hazard to the Pacific Northwest still hasn't happened, but it could any day now, so look on the bright side. We've got a new one. This field is called paleoseismology. Is that what you are, a paleoseismologist?
I am not. I know a lot of people who are, and I kind of plunder their data. Maybe plunder is the wrong word because I acknowledge and cite them, but I use their data to motivate my computer models of hypothetical future earthquakes or trying to understand past earthquakes. But I certainly have many friends and colleagues who are paleoseismologists.
So it's the past is prelude to what may be to come.
Yeah, it's basically if you can understand what the fault has done in the past, then that means it's certainly something that can happen in the future. It's not to say that it's always going to happen exactly the same way, but getting an understanding of a number of past earthquakes certainly gives us a better picture of any future ones.
So I saw the article in the LA Times about a big one that could be on the horizon, so to speak, in Southern California. And this is a combination of the San Andreas Fault and the San Jacinto Fault.
Well, you've actually got two different articles up there. So this one that you have on the screen is about the San Andreas and the San Jacinto. And that paper really that's based on research that I did over the past year. I had the paper published in the journal Science Advances. So it's open access if anyone wants to read
Yay.
The paper. And so what I was looking at was an earthquake that happened in the year 1812. So there were actually two big earthquakes in Southern California. 1912, the first of which is known to have affected the Inland Empire area and San Juan Capistrano in Orange County. So all of those squares on that plot, all of the orange squares represent Spanish missions that experienced either heavy damage in the case of San Juan Capistrano and San Gabriel and San Fernando to lighter damage such as in Ventura. All those places felt this earthquake. And then the orange line on the faults is where I think the earthquake happened, because an earthquake isn't just shaking. It is basically rupture unzipping along a fault. So it starts somewhere and propagates. And so that map that was up there a second ago was the one about the 1812 earthquake. And so all of the other squares directly on the fault there were paleoseismic sites. And so I guess to briefly define paleoseismology, it's basically if you think of paleontology as you're digging a hole and looking for dead stuff, in this case you're digging a hole and looking for maybe not a dead earthquake, but an earthquake that already happened, because it might if it rips through to the surface of the earth, then that kind of thing will be visible at any former surfaces of the earth. So yeah, what we're seeing now is an example of a rupture zipping down a fault. That's what's called the shakeout scenario, envisioning a 7.8 earthquake ripping down the entire southern San Andreas. The 1812 earthquake that I just published on was smaller than this. It's inferred to have been about a 7.5. But one thing that's super important about earthquakes is that it doesn't matter. It matters a lot less how big they are, and it matters a lot more where they are. So that Northridge earthquake that happened right here and left some cracks in the walls of what is now my office, in fact, that was a 6.7. That's not huge by the grand scheme of seismic energy, but it was under a densely populated area. So that's what you need for something to become really bad. You can have a magnitude 8 in the middle of nowhere, and it makes scientists very excited, and it might affect nobody other than the scientists. So
in 1812, LA was not exactly heavily developed. How do you have any even evidence of an 1812 earthquake? What are you looking at?
So one thing that was fun about this study is that I got to accumulate a whole bunch of different kinds of evidence to make a computer model. So I was looking at the records from the missions, who were saying, first of all, well, what did we do to make God really mad and cause this? But also then the description of what did or didn't fall down. So that's a picture of a mission that was damaged by the second 1812 earthquake, not the one that I was working on. So if you find one of San Juan Capistrano rather than – no, that's still the wrong one. So there was an earthquake in – there was a second earthquake in December of 1812 that was probably influenced by the first one. But you get the idea with those pictures, is that the missions got damaged and people wrote down what happened and sent it back to Spain in their reports. Yeah, that's San Juan Capistrano.
Can you infer how strong the earthquake was from just that anecdotal reporting?
You can start to get a picture of it, yeah, because the modern-day intensity scale, not magnitude but intensity, is based on how hard things shake and how much stuff breaks. And so by looking at the level of destruction described at the missions, and actually with San Juan Capistrano, they never rebuilt it, so you can still see what got knocked down. So looking at that can give you a sense of how hard it shook. And another thing we can actually look for is what's called precariously balanced rocks, which are exactly what they sound like. They're rocks that are perched on a pedestal that look like they should have been knocked over. But the fact that they haven't been knocked over means that they haven't experienced ground motion strong enough to knock them over. So then if you have these pieces of historical evidence, the positive evidence of damage from the missions, the negative evidence of strong shaking from the rocks, and then you make a computer model. So this, what we're seeing on the screen now is a computer model of the shakeout scenario. So this was done, I think this group, this is mostly a group from USC and San Diego State that did this model, but my models are something similar, and so if you look at then the ground motion from one of those models and compare them to places where we have records of some sort of ground motion, you can start to go, okay, so this model is or isn't reasonable compared to the data that we have. In the case of 1812, again, I was comparing the ground motion data to what we know about the missions and about the precarious rocks. And then I was also comparing the model of the earthquake rupture itself. So I wasn't just looking at, assuming some rupture length. I wanted to figure out, based on our best understanding of the physics of what's going on with these faults, where did the earthquake go? And so that's where the paleoseismic evidence really was an important data point, because we know that on both the San Andreas and San Jacinto faults, there is evidence for an earthquake, a larger earthquake that happened in the early 1800s. And so the models I did of the physics of the earthquake are trying to see, can that work? Can rupture start on one fault and go on to the other one? Can it take that exit down the freeway, as it were? And as it turns out, it can. Based on our best understanding of the physics, the San Andreas and the San Jacinto can go off together. Yeah, so here's some of my ground motion figures. So multi-fault earthquakes are not new. They've been well observed. If anyone remembers in Southern California in 1992, the Landers earthquake that ripped through the Mojave Desert on about 7 or 8 different faults. If anyone also remembers a big one offshore in Sumatra in 2012, not the one that caused the tsunami, but an 8.3 off Sumatra, that was a bunch of different faults. So having more than one fault go off at once is not unusual. But the question was, does it happen with the San Andreas? And I think it can. I think it did. The models that I did that involved both faults made a lot more sense with the patterns of damage than the ones with just one fault. So that's what I think happened.
Interesting. That's what happened in 1812.
Yeah, that's what I think happened in 1812. But if it's physically possible, then it would happen again.
If it happened once. What kind of computers do you use to simulate this? Is it a lot of data? Do you need to use a mainframe? What are you, a supercomputer?
It's a high-powered cluster, so it's a big super souped up Linux thing. And right now the code I'm using is not parallelized across nodes, so each node has 12 cores on the system. I did these models on the system at UC Riverside. I'm getting my own very soon, which I'm excited about. It's something that would make your standard desktop barf. It's a very intensive thing. They take about 36 hours to run with a model this size.
I would love to see a desktop barf, actually. I'm very curious.
I think I just did that to your Pixel.
Oh, it's back. It's back.
Oh, good. We power washed it. When it barfs, you power wash it.
Yes.
It's all back to normal. Well, what is the lesson that we can learn from this? Is it something people should be quickly digging holes in the ground and putting up a fall? I don't know. What do you do to prepare for an earthquake? It's kind of hard, isn't it?
So you can't prevent an earthquake, but what you can do is prepare for damage, because we can't know when it's going to happen. So many of people want these studies to be like, oh, so
right.
When is it happening? And
right.
The best that we can do is just a forecast. It's just a statistical forecast of everything we know about every fault. And so what we always say is
that's the Northridge quake fallout.
Interchange of the 5 and the 14. So it's just to be prepared in both for your house, like bolt your foundation. Certainly if you have a house, bolt your foundation. That's even more important than having insurance. Insurance is kind of a personal decision. Bolt your foundation, strap your furniture to the wall so it doesn't fall over. Get things like, tie your cabinets or, put a lock on your cabinets, like a childproof lock even, so they don't fly open and send your, for example, collection of pint glasses flying everywhere. Not that that would be a problem in my kitchen.
You don't have a collection of pint glasses? Well, we need to get you one, actually. I think it's just ironic that a seismologist is working at UC Northridge. You're sitting on the fault. And your office still has the cracks from 1994.
That's cracks.
That's UC. That's the UC system right there.
Cal State,
right.
The UC Berkeley is right on the Hayward Fault.
Right, right. But there's nothing we can do to predict, nothing we can do to – I mean, it could happen. It's been a while. It could happen today. It could happen in 100 years, right? I mean, there's no
– It could be at any time. So that other article that was in the news a lot lately that I had a bunch of people ask me in the last week was one that you briefly flashed on the screen earlier that said the San Andreas is, quote, locked, loaded, and ready to roll.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Or should we be afraid? And, this is an interesting case in that that's actually like kind of a true statement, but it's been true for a long time. So what this reflects is, a continued piece of understanding about the fault, that it has been a really long time since there's been a large earthquake on this part of the San Andreas. And other studies suggest that it happens more often than this. So just based on knowing how often it tends to happen, and especially with the part down near the Salton Sea in Coachella Valley, it usually has an earthquake on average of every 150 to 200 years. So that's just a simple interval question. And we know that the plate is still moving. There are other earthquakes happening. But at the same time, nothing has changed to make it like it's not like we suddenly realize it's more likely than it was before. This is sort of one of those like user end things that, you know, every few years we say, hey, the San Andreas is, right, you know, 10 months pregnant or locked, right, and loaded or ready, right, to blow or whatever. And people go, well, what are you doing that's different? But it's sort of on the back end that, you know, tons and tons more science is happening. The most recent version of the forecast uses many, many more kinds of details and models and data points than the previous version. It still comes to that conclusion that the San Andreas is the most hazardous fault in California, in Southern California in particular. In Northern California, it's the Hayward.
I think you better be careful, Julian, because it looks like if there's an earthquake, all of those journals are going to slide off that shelf.
Yeah, and my office is I'm not practicing my
strap those journals down. Stop it. Don't knock it over. Oh, my God. It's always good to talk to you. Julian Lozos, he's just a ray of light and always positive.
Positive ray of light.
Ray of light. All the good stuff. Yeah. Well, no, but it's good. You know, we always prepare right after the earthquake. I remember in 1989, after the earthquake, everybody was running around and get your wrench for your gas, find out where your water mains, your gas mains are, all this stuff. And, of course, a year later, whatever. So it's good to remind us once in a while, be prepared.
Hopefully people will eventually be ready before instead of deciding to get ready after.
Yeah, it's a little too late afterwards. Great to talk to you. Julian Lozos is a geophysicist, not a paleoseismologist. But he knows about this stuff, too, at the CSU Northridge. Thank you so much for joining us once again, Julie.
Thank you.
Always a pleasure to talk to you.
You too. Thank you.
I call him Doogie Lozos because he looks like he's about 15. But he's a smart kid. Very smart kid. Are you worried? You don't worry. No. Why? What are you going to do? What are you going to do? It's going to happen someday.
Do I worry? Of course.
Me worry?
I think my parents probably worry more than I do because I'm already living here.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I get that question every once in a while.
Fall
like,
off into the
so
ocean.
Seriously, it's going to happen. Like, what do you think about that? It's like, I don't want to think about
it. People live in California, we don't think about it until it happens.
Yeah.
Have you ever been in a big one?
I was not here for the big one.
Pretty nice.
And I mean, I've been in sizable earthquakes, but nothing that does like extensive damage.
It's pretty scary when you get a big one.
Yeah. Oh, I can only imagine.
Yeah. And I've only been in 6.8. That was the Loma Prieta. Okay. Coming up, Brian's going to take a look at a brand new action cam. I know he's a big GoPro fan, but can Rico beat GoPro? We'll find out in just a second. But first, a word from Braintree Payments, our sponsor on the show today. I know you want to put a payment system in your website or your mobile app, and you're thinking, maybe I could write this myself. No, don't do it yourself. Why do it yourself when you could go to Braintree? Braintree Payments, the same system used by the biggest, the best, like Uber and Lyft. Yeah, they both use Braintree Payments, and so does Airbnb and Hotels Tonight. GitHub uses Braintree. The Pinterest buyable pins you've seen on the web, that's Braintree Payments. That's contextual commerce. Braintree does it all. They make it possible for your site, for your app, to take every kind of payment, period. Everything your customers want, from pounds to PayPal, from Android Pay to Apple Pay to Bitcoin. It's all in there. Credit cards, too. Of course, it's secure, and your customers, they get it because they feel very comfortable. They don't have to leave your site. It really solves the problem of shopping cart abandonment on mobile. And it works in every platform you work in. Ruby, Python, PHP, Node.js, Java.net. It works on the web. It works on iOS. It works on Android. And when a new kind of payment method comes along, as Android Pay did last year, was it Google I.O., I think, when they announced it, you go to your control panel, you check a box, boom, it's in there. Simple, secure payments, code that's easy for you to integrate, secure, fast payouts to you, no late nights, no stress. Tell the boss, tell your product manager, get Braintree Payments in your code. Go to BraintreePayments.com/NSS. Play in the sandbox so you get a good idea of what it can do. Tell them when you go to work on Monday, I got it, I found it, BraintreePayments.com/NSS. And by the way, your first $50,000 in payments are fee-free. BraintreePayments.com. Ricohs.com. All right, now it's time to take a look at Ricoh's brand new action camera, the WGM2. Brian Burnett took it out for a ride.
There are two things that an action camera needs to be: compact and rugged. But to separate itself from the pack, it needs something more. Introducing the Ricoh WGM2. Coming in at $299.95, the Ricoh sets itself apart with its ultra-wide 204-degree lens and can record at 4K resolution at 30 frames per second. From a design standpoint, I really like the Ricoh. The buttons are easily reached. The LCD screen is easy to read, even in broad daylight. It's waterproof up to 20 meters without a protective housing. It's shockproof, coldproof, and has electronic image stabilization. Inside, it has an 8-megapixel sensor that will allow recording at 1080 at 60 frames per second, 720 at 120 frames per second, and, of course, 4K at 30. The WGM2 checks all the boxes in the action cam spec list, but how does it perform? Unfortunately, when recording at 4K, the ultra-wide 204-degree lens softens the edges of the video, making it appear blurry and out of focus. When recording at a lower resolution like 1080, you can narrow the field of view, lessening the effect, but it still doesn't help with make the video look any better. Compounding the poor focus is a sensor that struggles with light metering. When transitioning from sunlight to shadows and back, the video either looks blown out or underexposed. Another downside is when using a regular movie recording mode, the Ricoh only will record for 25 minutes and then stop, which means if the camera is out of reach or you forget how much time has gone by, you could come back to the camera and find it not recording. As for the total recording time, I was able to get nearly 2 hours of footage before having a dead battery, but your mileage will vary depending on the resolution you record at. There's also a slow-mo feature that allows you to capture video at 120 frames per second, but only at the lower resolution, so it doesn't look very sharp. The electronic image stabilization works okay, but when it's used on something like a motorcycle that leans side to side, the video ended up looking jerky as the camera tried to compensate. The wind noise reduction feature does seem to work, but overall the sound isn't very impressive. All in all, the Ricoh WGM2 has some very well-designed hardware aspects, but when pairing good design with merely average video quality at $300, the Ricoh is outperformed by something like a $250 GoPro Hero 3. While the GoPro 3 doesn't come with a screen, I'd gladly sacrifice that for better video. In the end, the WGM2 comes up short, especially when the two biggest selling points are 4K at 30 frames per second and 204-degree wide lens that both fall flat in execution. To really innovate the action cam space, I'd like Ricoh to create a rugged 360 recording camera, something similar to the other camera that they already make, the Theta S360. This has been Brian Burnett, and that's my review of the Ricoh WGM2.
Thank you, Ryan. Actually, that would be a good idea, wouldn't it? Get the 360 in a rugged environment. I'd like to see that.
That would be nice.
I'd love to see that. So I guess it's a do not buy for the Ricoh action cam. You know, the Hero is the one to beat. Everybody's going after the Hero. The GoPro is so, so good.
They've got it.
What were you doing to the tire there? Were you burning rubber?
That was just for the slow-mo, that's all.
Doesn't seem like a good idea.
That tire's on its way out.
Oh, okay. Anyway, well, it is now.
He has a whole stash of old tires that he saves for slow-mo shots.
Oh, that's good.
True.
Good to have. What kind of bike is that?
It's a Honda CBR.
Okay. You are our daredevil. That is Brian Burnett, who is also our technical director.
Anytime, Leo. Job.
Thank you, Brian. You can catch Brian on the Know-How Show with Father Robert Ballas here twice a week. Now, you ready for the mailbag, Jason?
I think so. Yeah, let's do this.
And here they are, our questions of the week from a viewer like you.
There's no Dinty more beef stew in there.
No, I don't know. I guess they stopped feeding us.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm going to give you this one.
All right.
Because I don't know why. I'll start, though.
All right.
I have email one. I've been debating using iTunes Match, and now I'm even more confused with all the news about it in recent weeks. I currently use Amazon's music backup, but would prefer to use Apple's. I have around 35,000 songs, 90% from my CD collection, the rest from iTunes and other digital stores. I'm wondering if you could walk me through doing it the right way to avoid screwing up my local library on my iMac. P.S. I don't use Apple Music. Jim Dalrymple. So, no, just Jim. We don't know if it's Dalrymple.
It could be.
The latest news on that, by the way,
is, remember, we talked last week about a designer, James Pinkhouse, who wrote a blog post on Vellum saying Apple Music deleted 120 gigabytes of my music. And, of course, Jim Dalrymple from The Loop, same complaint. Mm-hmm. In both
Maybe
cases,
it's just a problem that Jims are having.
It could be if your name is Jim, don't use that. Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Uh-oh. Mm-hmm. But in this case, Apple released a release yesterday saying, we're not sure exactly what's happening. We haven't been able to reproduce it, but they didn't poo-poo it. They said, we're going to release an update to iTunes next week that will make it harder for you to lose music. So I think in some respect, Apple may have... Remember, a lot of people said, oh, it's a user error. These guys named Jim, they're not so bright, whatever. I think Jim Dalrymple knows what he's doing. I do, and I don't know James Pinkstone, but I don't want to blame the user. I always want to say, well, you know, let's find out what happened.
Yeah.
And Apple, in some respect, is doing the same. They're saying, we're not going to blame the user. We're going to do what we can to make it right. We can't reproduce it, which usually means we don't know what bug there is, if there's a bug at all.
Mm-hmm. And thankfully, the person that this happened to last week that lost all of their, you know, music, they had it all backed up.
Right.
So I think the overarching point there then is just, you know, even, you know, when this stuff is happening, we put a lot of trust into
exactly
these services.
Right.
And it's, you know, probably wise to just get a backup.
So step one, Jim, back it up.
Yeah.
Yeah. So then no matter what you do, you've got a hard copy backup. Maybe get a, you know, hard drives are so cheap now.
They are.
Go out to Costco, buy a terabyte, 2 terabytes. How about a 3 terabyte drive? No, 4 terabyte Seagate drive for a couple $100.
Not even that. Yeah.
Back it all up. Put that somewhere aside. Then you can experiment a little bit. Mm-hmm. Here's my advice. Don't combine Apple Music with iTunes Match. Experts seem to think this might be related to the problem that the two Jims are having. And you too may be Jim because you have the name, is that Apple's never been clear what the difference and the interaction are between iTunes Match and Apple Music.
Right.
First of all, iTunes Match is you say a backup is not a backup service. It's a matching service. So what they do is they look at your collection. Any song that they can match, if it's 96 kilobits per second or better, MP3 or better, they will match with a 256 kilobit AAC song from the iTunes library, copy protection free. That's iTunes Match. It's $25 a year. If they don't have a copy of it, then they will back it up. They'll upload it. If it's something you created or something they don't own, they will upload it. So in that respect, it's a backup. But it's not a backup for the songs they match. And this is important, and I think this is where people lose music, is assuming that this song they matched is a backup. It only is if it was a correct match. And the problem with all music matching is it's often incorrect. You write a lot of music. Mm-hmm. What if it matches a Yellow Gold song to a song by another group, let's say Herman's Hermits, and then you think you got your song, and instead you have some Herman Hermits song.
Yeah,
it's not what you want. Yeah. That would be bad, especially if deleted the original.
That especially. I mean, if it's just confusing in the cloud, that's one thing. But if it's deleting anything off the local, that's another thing.
Matching is inherently inaccurate, so don't assume that a match is a backup.
Okay. Especially considering the fact that there are a lot of live versions. Some people collect live shows for certain artists, and you never know. It could match based on metadata that says that this is a live version of Let It Go or whatever.
That's exactly right. It's one of the things that happened to Pinkstone.
It replaces it incorrectly.
He said he had a rare Fountains of Wayne single. Apple replaced it with the widely released single. Now, to Apple, that looks the same. To you, there's a big difference. Now, to my knowledge, Apple does not delete music. But Apple even is kind of saying, well, maybe we did. We're going to have to look into this. So, yeah, it'd behoove you to have a copy.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't use both iTunes Match and Apple Music. I would use one or the other. They have similar capabilities. But do remember that Apple Music will only continue to work as long as you continue to pay for it. As soon as you stop paying for it, those songs are no longer matched. So really always better to keep your own copies if you have them. The other problem is if you're burning, as you should be with your CDs, if you're ripping Apple lossless or FLAC, the highest quality, unlossy compression, the iTunes Match will match them to a lossy compression, to AAC. So you don't want to do that. You want to keep the FLAC versions of your songs. If you've got CDs you're ripping, if you've ripped CDs, rip them as FLAC or Apple lossless. Both of those are great formats. You won't lose any of the quality from the original. And then back that up. And then if you want to use Match, go ahead. Or use Apple Music, but just I feel like Apple Music and Match may not mesh perfectly. Hmm. I use Match. I don't use Music. Mm-hmm. That's my choice.
Or just Google Music. You know,
I love Google Music. You know what? And that does pretty much the same thing. It doesn't do matching, but it'll upload stuff.
Yeah.
Does it do matching? I guess it kind of does, but it doesn't replace.
Yeah, I don't think
that it
does.
So you can't re-download, right?
Because, I mean, but it's been a long time since when it started, when I uploaded my entire library. As far as I know, this was a couple of years ago. It just uploaded everything.
It's convenient, and this is the convenience of iTunes Match and Apple Music, is you don't have to have it on your phone. You can stream any song that's in the collection just down to your phone, so it saves you space on the phone.
For sure. Our other here is from Susan in Seattle, who says, is there any way to connect my Pixel C to the internet via coax connection to my Mocha network? I have a room far away from the router and from the Wi-Fi extender. It's where I sew. I want to watch Twit live when I sew, but the Wi-Fi is too spotty. My outlets are too flaky for powerline Ethernet. There's no good way to string or hide an Ethernet cable, but I have this lovely coax plug. My Romeo TiVo creates a very nice Mocha network that works perfectly, so I'm thinking that I should be able to plug my devices, mainly a Pixel C, into the internet that way. Yes? With adapters of some kind or Druid magic, perhaps?
It's going to take Druid magic.
Yeah.
So Mocha is a coax cable based internal networking. It goes over your cables inside your home, and like any hardwired system, it's going to be more reliable than Wi-Fi and travel over a greater distance.
There are a ton. There's a pretty good size list of certified products on the Mocha site, and I know there was one that kind of stood out: the WCB6200. Q. It's a 802.11n AC wireless network extender with gigabit Ethernet and bonded Mocha.
So you could use the Mocha to get to a distant spot, but then you would connect an adapter, not your Pixel C, but a Wi-Fi adapter
to the Mocha. That's what it would have to be. Yeah.
It would become a base station in your in your sewing room, and now your Pixel C or anything else would get high-quality Wi-Fi. ActionTech makes one. There's a lot of companies that make them. So that will connect to the coax. You'll have a Mocha network. It will get, one hopes, if Mocha's working for you, a high-quality signal into the Wi-Fi adapter.
Right.
And become your Wi-Fi signal.
That should be sufficient, I would imagine.
Yeah. I don't know of any way to get Ethernet into a Pixel C.
You know, I did some poking around on that, and I saw mixed results. Like, I saw an anchor USB breakout box or whatever. It wasn't made specifically for the Pixel C, but there was a comment that said, oh, yeah, I got that working with basic networking functionality. So I didn't find enough to be able to kind of recommend it as a solution. I do know that from what Susan is looking at, doing some sort of Ethernet in that room might not even be an option necessarily to begin with. So that makes that a moot point, possibly.
So think of the Mocha network as like a power line network. She says her power line. I use power line networking, same idea, where the electrical grid becomes the data carrier to a distant point. And then I put Wi-Fi on that. So think of the Mocha network as similar, not power line, but based over your coax. It's distributing the connectivity to your sewing room, and then you're connecting the ActionTech to make it into Wi-Fi. I think that's the easiest way to do it. In fact, I'm tempted to kind of try it because a lot of us have coax throughout the house for our cable, the cable system. It'd be nice to be able to use that as an Ethernet extender, in effect, since we don't these days have Ethernet everywhere. It's so interesting. We're seeing so many products for bad Wi-Fi. This is obviously a massive problem now.
Well, yes, we rely on Wi-Fi for so many things now that I think it's just way more obvious to us the fact that it doesn't travel everywhere we need it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So you're carrying the HTC 10.
Yes. Well,
I'm going to keep using the S7. Mm-hmm. Is there a new phone around the corner? Did we gave up on the LG G5, right? That was okay, not great.
Yeah, I don't know if the LG G5 has won too many hearts.
Is Ron Richards still using his Robin?
Yes, he's likes a big the Robin. Fan of the Robin, actually.
Okay. I gave my Robin away.
He really likes the next bit Robin.
It's pretty.
I think the one that I'm looking forward to is actually two, and that is the rumored HTC Nexi devices.
And they might announce that Wednesday.
Maybe. I'm guessing it's probably going to be end of summer, yeah. Which it tends to be when they make those announcements for new Nexus devices. But the rumors are pointing pretty strongly to HTC doing not but one but two, and based on the HTC 10 that we've seen and I like, I'm very curious to see what they come up with.
Yeah.
I like HTC. I want them to succeed.
Huawei did the 6P and LG did the 5X. Mm-hmm. And Google likes to spread it around. So it's HTC's turn. They made the first Android phone. Yeah. They still have that, the G1. Mm-hmm. I'm waiting for the Note 6. August 15th, the rumors say we'll see the new Samsung Galaxy Note 6. I love the Note. 5.8 inches this time. Mm-hmm. I'm not, you know, it's funny. I would say I'm not a Samsung fan. Mm-hmm. I kind of like think they junk up their phones and stuff. And yet I've been very, very happy with the
S7. Pretty loyal to the Note, yeah. Regularly when
I've
it comes.
I've had every Note.
I know. Every time it comes out, you get one.
So. Jam the pen in backwards, whatever. I hope they fix that in a new one. Jason Howell talks about Android all the time, every week, every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Pacific, 8 p.m. Eastern time, and midnight UTC, and all about Android. And, of course, you and Megan do a great job Monday through Friday.
Thank you.
With our daily tech news show, TNT. That's at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern.
We're having a lot of fun with tech
news. It's a great show.
We're enjoying it. Yeah. You know, really, when we went into kind of taking on the kind of the new direction of the show, we just, our promise to each other was, let's talk about things we really want to talk
about. Care about. Yeah.
And so we end up getting these great interviews with people that maybe aren't necessarily the top tech news stories of the day, but they're really insightful interviews on important topics that have, you know, that involve social change. And I don't know, it makes us feel good to do some of these interviews with people and shine a light on certain things.
I think
things.
That's the way to do it. You can get the top tech news in a million different ways. It's on the web, you get in 5 seconds, it's on your phone.
Yeah.
But getting that insight and that context, that's something that's really special when you add that. I like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jason. Always great to have you. Next week, Ian Thompson joins us on the new Screensavers. I hope you will too. We do it every Saturday afternoon at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, 2200 UTC. See, the beer did not impair my UTC calculations at all. And you can watch live if you will. Join us in the chat room. But if you can't, or be in the studio. We had a great studio audience. Thank you guys for being here. You can email tickets at twit.tv. We'll put a chair out for you. Otherwise, get one of the on-demand versions, audio or video. That's at twit.tv/NSS or on iTunes and the podcast apps everywhere and our Twit apps everywhere. Subscribe. That way you'll get every single episode. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you next time on the new Screensavers. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Nice studio audience.
Look at that.
Look at that crowd.